I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there. Welcome along to the Huddle Breakdown. Endicall here along with Juco James and Alan Morrison. How are we doing, folks?
All right.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, a week off. Nothing to complain about this week. It's good.
Exactly. People will be rejoicing. We are not doing any complaining about Celtic. Well, we might do a little bit of complaining about Celtic. We don't have a game to analyze on this week's show. So we're doing what we threatened to do for the last about 4 or 5 months at least. We're going to do a Q&A style show. So on Twitter at Huddle Breakdown, we asked you to send us in some of your questions. So we have a fair few of them coming in on Twitter. Thanks to everyone who did send in questions. And if you do want us to cover something else on another show, do send us some questions on Twitter as well. And we'll try to get to as many as we can in the next hour or so. If you're watching on YouTube or you're watching on Twitch or you're listening to us for the first time, hit the subscribe button. You'll get notified every time a new podcast or a new video is live. And you just get free content every single week. So we'll start with the questions that came in. I want to start with a very simple one that came in. And it's a controversial one. It's one that always comes up. Is a Jaffa cake a biscuit or is it a cake? Now, James, I'm not sure if you guys have Jaffa cakes in the US, but it is basically this small circular, we'll call it a biscuit for now, because just for handiness sake, it's cake on the bottom. It's got a chocolate covering and it's got a little orange sort of gelatin bit inside of it. The answer to this is a cake. A Jaffa cake is a cake. And the reason it is a cake, if you leave a cake out, so if you leave a Jaffa cake outside without any coverings on, it goes hard. If you do that with a biscuit, it goes soft, it goes soggy. So that is the answer to the most controversial question that came in. And surprisingly enough, we're a Celtic podcast. For that to be the most controversial question to come in, I think we're doing pretty well.
See you next week.
Great. We're a lot of science down here.
Whatever you call it, I have had those and I'm not a fan. So I don't care what you call it. No, thank you.
Well, that's even more controversial than the
even with stuff. Even with a cup of tea, the orange part of it puts me
off. Oh, come on. Right. We'll start off with the actual questions here. Michael Nolan, who is a regular listener to the show, he always tweets us as well. So thank you, Michael, for sending in this question. He says that surely we knew before the window closed that an injury to McGregor would be a problem, question mark. I'm going to change his phrasing of the next part. Is that not why Halliday tried to do him in? Says Michael. I think that's a pretty obvious one. That is one that we have touched on last week on the podcast, but I guess we'll throw it out to the crowd again. Not only do we risk McGregor pulling a hamstring or getting a muscle tear, our team's going to target him now, I guess, is what Michael is asking.
Well, a trip through Andy Halliday's head would be a very short and fruitless journey, I have to say. So I'm not sure what he was thinking when he went into McGregor, but yeah, maybe that was part of it. Listen, I think, you know, if we said the midfield is in quite a state when you think about the way that Celtic and Postecoglou want to play and the actual resources that we have at our disposal. If you think the system is going to be like a six, which is more of a six in the sort of regista, if I can use a nice hipster phrase, of the sort of deep lying playmaker style of player, and then two number eights, and by number eights we mean more sort of box to box, multi-functional players that can break up attacks, but also get into the box, have shots, etc. If you think about that, that's obviously the way that we've played hitherto. McGregor is really good in that number six position, and probably more effective there even than as an eight, but I think he can probably do both. And there really isn't anyone else who naturally in the central midfield plays that role. You've got Turnbull, who arguably can be that eight, but he seems to struggle when the pace of the opposition and the intensity of the game and the standard of the game increases. And he may be more comfortable as a 10, which is more of a forward position behind a striker, more focused on the creative aspects and getting shots away than doing some of the midfield donkey work that an eight would do. Rogic clearly has always been a classic 70s throwback to what a 10 was, a player who's really not that interested in the physical side of the game, really wants to get on the ball and do creative stuff with it. And then you've got McCarthy, who's more of a Scott Brown type of six, which is not that deep line playmaker, more that first line of last defence, if you like, in front of the back four, breaking play up and just keeping the game very simple. So those are the players we've got, but actually what we need players, dare I say it, a little bit like Ryan Christie in the 2-8 positions, energy, aggression, a bit of pace, got a goal threat, loves the challenge. You need two of those and then a McGregor type. So we're just massively exposed. And then beyond those players, we've got essentially kids, really, and that's it. So it's just a huge problem, I think, or risk, should I say, for the rest of the season.
Can I ask a follow-on question before you come in here, James? You might be able to answer this for me. Outside of James McCarthy, do we have enough assholes in our midfield? Do we have enough players who are going to sort of give as good as they get to, in order to ensure that people who try and do Cal McGregor are equally get it equally a hard tackle back? We cannot hear you, James.
That's my dog barking sensor as usual. Apologies. Unsurprisingly to you, I have a bit of a contrarian view on that. I think given the relative disparity in Celtic's quality versus most of the league, getting dragged down into that kind of physicality and, you know, tit for tat type of stuff is more about theater than being smart and, you know, doing what's best competitively to try and win matches. If you can dance like a butterfly and sting like a bee, like Cassius Clay could when he first became heavyweight champion, you know, you don't go toe to toe and just sit there and get pummeled to do it. I mean, you use your athleticism, you use your pace, you use your skill level, and you make that the weapons that you deploy. There's obviously a balance to strike. To kind of segue off of one of Alan's comments, I think one of our challenges is that we have some what I'll call tweeners. So I see David Turnbull as a tweener. I don't think he really suits as an eight, a box-to-box eight. But I also don't think he necessarily at this point anyway, maybe he develops into it. But Alan and I have talked about this over the last almost year now, is that, you know, it's a bit of a mixed record as far as him as a 10. So it's almost situational, you know, he's a tweener. He's kind of stuck in between those two. And as I continue to talk about this kind of concept of optimization, when you optimize a system, you have pieces that fit together in an optimized way. And when you have tweeners, that's harder to do. And, you know, if all things being equal, if McGregor was 3 inches taller, 20 pounds heavier, and a little bit more aggressive in the tackle, then he'd be almost perfect in that position. You know, he could handle the ball progression, the breaking of the press, as well as kind of doing a good enough job as, you know, like a 28-year-old or a 30-year-old Scott Brown did in breaking up play. So it's really about picking the relative weaknesses and strengths and how they're going to fit together and complement each other or expose each other, in my mind. And I think that's yet to be determined. And I think it's going to be situational depending on how opponents decide to set up against us. I think that there's the conscious decision to go after a player, which, you know, for the most part, I think is not all that common. You know, there's certainly players that are like that, that'll try to go out and hurt people. But I think for the most part, that's, you know, less common. I think my bigger concern is how the Scottish League is officiated in general, which is, I did a thread on this a while back, is, you know, normally in pyramids, the top league in a country will have the lowest fouling rate, the lowest yellow card rate. And then they go up as you go down. Like, you know, Serie C has like 30% more fouls and yellow cards than Serie A, right? So that makes sense. And if you go through Portugal, you go through Spain, you go through Germany, there are a little bit of variation, but for the most part, that sequencing, and it makes sense. You know, they're better players at the higher level and they play a more technical, sophisticated style of game. So that all kind of makes sense. Well, if you teleport into the UK, that doesn't hold up. So the Premier League in England or the Premiership in Scotland actually have higher rates of fouling being called than, let's say, League Two or yellow cards, for example, which, you know, to me, that's a cultural issue as far as how the game is officiated and how much physicality, and we talk about it all the time, you know, how much physicality is let go, how much players, creative players aren't protected with some of these just vicious tackles. So I would be concerned about that in general, as because of our risk and exposure of McGregor. And I'm not sure which is worse in that sense. I mean, I don't know if him playing that central six is going to make him more likely to get hammered more. I suspect probably not. Whereas maybe in that box to box role might be a little bit more susceptible to violent collisions, shall we say. And then the other part of all this is just a general risk that all the clubs are going to have to deal with is COVID still. So I think we've seen now that vaccines are not kind of universal 100%. And, you know, so there's a scenario where some of our best players are out for a week or two with COVID, as we've seen already with other clubs. So, you know, that's the scenario where we lose McGregor for a week or two, I think we could live with, depending on who the opposition are during that stretch of games. You know, any other kind of long-term injury, I think, would be a big, big problem.
Yeah, there's a lot in that, especially the refereeing thing, because that used to be a massive thing, particularly in the Champions League discussion around referees, was the physicality of the Premier League compared to the way that European competitions were officiated, that it is different. I think that's narrowing a little bit, but officiating on the island of Britain in general is really, really poor. And that's reflected in the amount of British referees that are selected for the highest games, the biggest games in the World Cup and the European competitions and the Champions League final. I know there's a couple of high profile English ones, but outside of that, it's a very, very select few that actually make it to the highest level. So officiating is something that needs to be certainly looked at in Scotland and beyond. There are a good few questions about the defence that I might throw together at the end, because that's probably going to take up the most length in terms of discussion. So we'll move on to a question that came in from Cristoforo on Twitter, saying that Ainz admitted that Kyogo's best position is central following the derby. So how will he accommodate both him and Giakoumakis? It doesn't make sense to have a rotation option in Giakoumakis, who appears to have a quite different playing style to the first choice. So essentially what he's asking is Giakoumakis going to be playing alongside Kyogo? And if he's not, is the game plan going to change when Giakoumakis is there instead of Kyogo?
Well, that's going to be quite a shift if we suddenly go to two up top and actually go two up top with the only two strikers that we've got in the squad that the manager actually wants to play. That would seem very unlikely. So to me, common sense suggests that, you know, he'll continue to play roughly the system he's playing, and it'll be one of two. But, you know, Kyogo is a very high intensity player, in terms of the just the sheer effort he puts into the game. He's tended to come off around the 60 to 70 minute mark in most games. He's obviously been on the receiving end of sort of violence in virtually every game he's played, not just in Scotland. So, you know, I don't think Giakoumakis is going to be short of minutes. He's a similar player in the sense of the level of intensity and work rate that he will bring to the game. So I suspect both of them will see significant minutes as a single striker. And the rest of it really comes down to what the very point that James made is, how do you fit the jigsaw pieces together around that to make it coherent? And, you know, if you assume that you know, Kyogo won't be on the left, which may be something that happens occasionally, and actually he does well there because he's a good player, probably not something we're going to see a lot of, then you're left with, okay, well, if Forrest isn't fit, then it's Jota. Jota's not played that many games of professional football, really. How long is he going to take to adjust to Scottish football? And then you're down to Adam Montgomery. And that's where we are. Again, these are all risks that could come to fruition with an injury or somebody losing form or Jota not adapting. And suddenly you're going, well, how do I make this puzzle fit? Because actually I don't have the right pieces for this to be a coherent system.
The question that I would ask in relation to Giakoumakis is, I think Boys Analytics did quite a bit of this on his Twitter in terms of the type of goals he scores. A lot of them are from high crosses. We seem to have been working on low crosses across the 6-yard box and pullbacks to the center, the penalty spot so far this season. So James, how does that pair into what Giakoumakis does in terms of his aerial ability? Do we change our game plan when he's on the pitch, or is it the same old story with him?
I generally agree with Alan in that there's such different players. I don't think Giakoumakis is in the same neighborhood as Kyogo as far as quality and what I've looked at and the analysis I've done. It's pertaining specifically to your question, and that kind of segues into one of the questions I have about how other teams are going to kind of set up against us. So I see two very distinct strategies that aren't earth-shattering, but I see vulnerabilities for Celtic that both of them could look to capitalize on. One is the high press, aggressive high press, but not all the teams have the quality and the athleticism and being coached well enough to do that and to really come at us in our defensive third and not get absolutely ripped apart, particularly at Celtic Park. But I do think some will try it, and there are some that are, you know, like a Hibs might be good enough to give us some real troubles in that regard. Rangers, if they decided to go that route, even though we've talked about that's probably not how they would do it. The other one is to just bunker in, close down that space. And to me, that would be the way to try and dilute some of the impact of Kyogo, meaning that one of his great strengths is using that space to run off the center backs. And if they're camped in at their own 18, there's not a lot of space for him to do that. So if you're going to park the bus, compress space, I could see Giakoumakis being an alternative if we are confronted with those kind of bunkering opposition, where some of those high crosses could be a way of mixing it up and trying to break teams down. So that's one way I could see it happening, whether that's within a game and changing it up. The other part of this is that Kyogo's already played a lot this year coming from Japan. He came to us mid-season. He's also been on international duty. He's going to be coming back from Japan probably today, I think.
James. He limped off today. He got substituted in the 50th. He went off injured.
So
we're already potentially looking at one of these risks becoming a massive issue, right?
I didn't know
for
that.
For listeners of the podcast, that weird noise you heard was James banging his head off his mic.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's great news.
I don't know any more than that, right?
Yeah,
he kind of limped off. Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully, it's just a knock, but
it could be a bang, you know, impact.
Yeah, but again, that comes back to, I mean, he's already played quite a bit this season, And the idea that he's just going to go straight through from basically, let's say, late January when the J League starts, I think, early February. I'm not sure exactly when that is, or very early in the year, and stretch out basically to a 15-month season and play in what could be 70 to 80 games over that stretch, I think is probably not realistic, even if he goes through that without getting any significant injuries. So there's going to have to be rotation. We're playing across four competitions. You know, so there's going to be minutes for Giamakis, I think, within that, you know, playing in early League Cup, where we play Wraith, I think, coming up in the League Cup. I mean, that could be a game, those kind of things. So I can see in Juranovic, one of the things that I saw when I looked at him before he was signed, when he was rumored, was he is actually pretty good at those kind of early deep crosses, you know, almost like a Barisic or a Tavernier. And he actually comped with Tavernier quite well in that regard in the analysis that I had done. So we have at least one fullback that seems like he could deliver those balls to a striker that's adept at attacking them. So that's kind of how I would think about it. But, I don't see him being in the neighborhood as far as quality. So I would be surprised if we end up where in any big games, Kyogo would be on the left, and Giamakis, I'll struggle with that till I die. Giamakis is kind of the preferred number nine.
Yeah. Mm.
So I think it's a good option to have at least. And but I think my serious questions around Giamakis is, why did he explode in the Eredivisie last year? And can we recreate those conditions? Can he recreate those conditions? Was it form or was it quality? And I think we'll learn over the next couple of weeks whether what situation it was that led to him scoring so many goals in the Eredivisie, and why he wasn't snapped up by a club as soon as Vivi Venlo got relegated from it. So it's an interesting time at Celtic. We're seeing a lot of faces, so I'm always willing to give them an opportunity to prove themselves. So I think 2 to 3 weeks we'll soon begin to see what his role is going to be within the side. There are a good few big games coming up, mainly in the Europa League over the next couple of weeks. And one of the questions coming in from Paul Smith is that with the step up in class in the Europa League, will we see pragmatism from Ange, and can we get out of the group? For those who haven't seen the group stage or forgot what the group stage is Real Betis, Bayer Leverkusen, and it is Ferencváros, a return to Ferencváros, Celtic's old enemies. Three green and white sides in the Europa League, but three very difficult sides as well. Two mainly very strong sides, and then Ferencváros, who I think we hope we can beat second time around. So pragmatism from Ange, is that something we're going to see, or are we going to see more go for the gut like we saw against AZ in the playoffs?
Yeah, so I think he probably has displayed a little bit more pragmatism than I expected already. I think it's also very difficult to be too overly judgmental at this stage, given the resources he's had to juggle. So he's had to make selections, and I think Ibrox was a perfect example of that, having to make selections to work around the available resources. My reading of Postecoglou is that he will be telling that Celtic team, and I don't care how bereft and under-equipped the squad is, he'll be telling the players that are there today, we're entering this competition to win it. That will be his attitude. And you might say, well, all professional teams will adopt that attitude, but some will be thinking, look, this is the guys, our targets, like, 6 points, win all the home games, right? That could be a target. Or a target is, we absolutely finish third and we get to the next stage or what have you. I believe his mentality will be to start from the position that we enter this to win it, and then he goes from that basis onwards. Now, and actually, can he get those players to overperform in those games? So I don't believe his attitude, or the attitude that he will instill in the players, will be, we've made our Europa money for the year. It's a free hit. We'll concentrate on the league. I do not buy that Postecoglou will be playing, getting the team to play in that way. Having said all that, two of the teams certainly that were playing in Leverkusen and Betis are exceptionally good sides. they're realistically going to be, you know, it's probably several levels above, unfortunately, you know, where we are at this point in time. You know, Leverkusen have already played three Bundesliga games and already scored four goals twice. They're a very well-coached team.
We've scored six goals twice, Alan.
Not against Borussia Mönchengladbach, unfortunately, away from home. I think it was Augsburg away and Borussia Mönchengladbach at home. So they're already, you know, already started the season strongly. They have got a new manager. So the Dutch manager Bosch has gone to Lyon, who took them up to, you know, high position in the Bundesliga last year. They've got Gerardo Sioni, who had been manager of Grasshoppers and Lucerne, and young boys. I think they had the first ever foray into the Champions League on the back of his efforts, and they're a team who again are one of the sort of pioneering data driven clubs. So, you know, that you can expect a team that's going to not just set out to play the way they always play, expect a team to look at Celtic closely and set up in a very intelligent way and to have very powerful resources to give us a lot of problems. Having said all that, I don't think Postecoglou will go gung-ho. My evidence for that is he played the way he played against Midtjylland when down to 10 men. He made a very pragmatic call about the team shape. And on the face of it, it was quite aggressive in pushing Rogic to play more as a striker. But actually, what he did was he made the team very, very compact. And actually, you know, it was very difficult to break us down from when we were down 10 to 10 men. And then against Alkmaar as well, I think the way that we saw the game out at 2-0 at Celtic Park was actually, you know, pretty impressive in terms of we pressed far more intelligently and less frequently. We sat back in more of a medium block, and again, we were compact and tight, and they really didn't have a shot after the 67th minute of any note. So I take those two things as being a sign that he will adjust. It won't be all guns blazing, but he will send those teams out to win those games.
James, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope what Alan is describing is going to be the case, because I fear the alternative. If and I'm not sure if pragmatism is the right word, but maybe more reserved. So within the context, I don't expect him to pull a Rodgers Barcelona where he goes in and just plays 5-4-1 and you know, parks the bus. Which, you know, again, I think a lot of people criticized Rodgers for not being pragmatic. And then when he tried that once, we got absolutely annihilated. So I would be surprised if we do that. But I think, like Alan has said, I hope there are some tweaks. And I've done some research on this over the break here. Some of the metrics, the more advanced metrics on pressing, are suggesting what is commonsensical, which is we're not very good at it yet. So if you look at counter-pressing and pressing data, we're just not accomplishing the amount of possession regains, for example, that would be normally expected given the intensity with which we're pressing, right? So we're having a lot of the energy being expended, a lot of the risk created in transition as a result of being aggressive and press, but we're not having a commensurate amount of kind of reward relative to all of that effort and risk that we're taking. Mm-hmm. So as I always say, that's more of a problem as you scale up in competition, where teams can have the talent and the speed and the pace and being well coached in order to take advantage of that. So I'm worried that if we go in guns blazing against, let's say, a Leverkusen, and we don't improve enough in our pressing and counter pressing, and we do it anyway, that could turn into some pretty rough nights, I think. Whereas if we maybe go more into a mid block and are more selective and smart about our pressing, as Alan said that we were, but we did those from positions of strength and mm-hmm. kind of hanging on. I think it'll be interesting from the get-go whether or not we set up that way to begin, or because I think particularly with Leverkusen, Betis a little bit lesser degree, but still, you know, they're a good side, but not quite as attacking and a pressing team as Leverkusen are.
Yeah.
And we can't write off Ferencváros. I mean, Ferencváros got through Slavia Praha 2-1 in aggregate to get to the knockout round of the Champions League. And based, I think they lost on penalties to Young Boys. That's what I'm saying. It was 3-2 and then 2-3. It was 6-4 in aggregate then. Yeah, it was 6-4 in aggregate. So it's not like, you know, that they were in that tie against Young Boys. For them to score 4 goals against Young Boys.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to be very interesting because that's whether or not where does Ange decide to kind of place his bets in some of these structural deficiencies we're going to have? Does he go with a McCarthy at the 6 and kind of accept what that's going to do to build up play? Or does he go with McGregor there and then try to figure something out as whoever's going to play that second 8 along with Turnbull?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Or whether he goes with 2 6s and, and a 10. But there again, you're setting yourself up for transition issues big time. I think it's going to be fascinating and it's going to come quick. I mean, I think as soon as we play Saturday next week, right? I think we have the first, we go to
Betis away. Yeah.
Real Betis. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, we'll not have to wait too long to get some answers here.
Well, I think that's the beauty of these international breaks is that you actually, for players who aren't away on them, you can actually prepare them for these kind of games. The pragmatic approach is an interesting one because I think there is a common misconception that pragmatism equals 10 men behind the ball and just holding out the fort, whereas you can be pragmatic and positive. You don't have to be completely negative. You can take the game to the teams and also be pragmatic about your approach. It's just certain ways of how you set up the team. So I can imagine it's going to be something in between. I can't see Celtic pressing every single ball against Leverkusen, but when they get the opportunity, I think they will. And I think they'll play largely with Kyogo. I can imagine Kyogo is going to take up a lot of wide positions against Leverkusen in particular to get them on the counter-attack with his pace, as opposed to his usual inside runs and behind the defense. So look, there's a lot of things that we won't actually know about Ange just because of the way that, you know, the J League is just not really in our mindset, and we haven't really seen too much of him at this level to see what he's actually going to do. We do have a good few questions on the defense. I'm going to lump them all in together because they're largely covering similar enough topics. So Forlorn Hope on Twitter says that can you give us some tactical solutions between now and January to solve the issues of the gaps between Hart and his backline while still playing Ange's high intensity style? Burnt Toast said, how are we going to pass it about the back with Starfelt and Hart who are uncomfortable with the ball at the feet? Teams with any sense will target them. And then Kev Boy asks, is a left-footed central defender key to us addressing the one-sided attacks when building up? Starfelt and Welsh never seem to open up their body and look to go down the right. McGregor receiving the ball facing his own goal tends to turn on his favourite side. So that's sort of three different questions about the defence. One about the way that we pass the ball out. One about how we position our key players, and one about the issues with the defense of the defense, essentially the defending style of the defense. So which one of you wants to start with what question there?
I'll have a go about the last one because I can remember it.
So that was
my memory's fading.
For podcast listeners, that was the question about left-footed central defender. Left-footed central defender key to opening up our one-sided attacks.
Yeah, that was a lot of words. I don't know if it goes back even before this, but if you think back to probably when Kieran Tierney got into the team, and certainly when Rodgers bought Sinclair, Celtic have been a very left-sided, biased team in terms of how they play. And I think it's still largely true today, mainly due to the personnel that we've had. So when the alignment was Tierney with McGregor next to him and then Sinclair, and then you had Dembele tended to drop slightly to the left, and then Edouard certainly dropped into the left. You had a lot of players that wanted to get on the ball and players that you wanted to get on the ball on that left side. Whereas on the right side, you tended to have Lustig, who didn't tend to bomb on and was more likely to tuck in one and shuffle everyone round so that Tierney was then free. And then Forrest, who was more of a out-and-out winger versus Sinclair, who was always looking to cut in, and therefore that freed up space wide for someone on the left to make that run. So you'd more like to get an overload on the left. So the ball would naturally be going in that direction. And since then, you know, McGregor is a ball magnet. I mean, McGregor demands the ball, and you want him on the ball. And he tends to, if you look at a heat map of McGregor, it does tend to be that left half space. If you drew a line down the half space between the fullback and the centre back and the inside midfielder through to the centre circle, that's kind of McGregor's zone of operation more often than not. So I think that's the main reason, and for historical reasons of personnel. And now we're in a situation where, you know, Abada is again one of these players who doesn't look like he's going to get a lot of touches in the game. It's just not his nature to be coming back, linking play. You know, he wants to get on it in dangerous areas, and then he'll do something explosive, and you'll get a few of those in the game. Whereas, you know, on the left, again, we've got players who are probably more comfortable taking more touches. And again, we've had the right-back issue. It'll be interesting having Juranovic now. Now, that might do something to actually balance the team out a little bit more. But we don't know yet, because it's another thing we've yet to learn. So in terms of going back to the original question, which is, if you had a left-sided centre-back, would that open up the play? I don't think it would have solved or changed any of those dynamics that I've just mentioned, whether the centre-back had been left-footed or right-footed. In fact, a right-footed centre-back would be generally shoveling the ball out to the left more, accentuating that. A left-footed centre-back obviously would be maybe coming inside. I know some people are really passionate about this and think that you must have a left-sided centre-back and a right-sided centre-back. And my kind of sort of natural feng shui might kind of instinctively say that I think that's a good idea, but I don't know that I've got any data to back that up per se, but I'd be interested if anyone's done any research on, is a lefty-righty combination better than not? I suspect having two good players is better than having a lefty and a righty for the sake of it.
I don't care. Yeah. I don't care if he's left-sided or not. All I want to know is, can he play football?
And I mean, put it this way.
Like you can have a left-sided donkey. It just really depends how good they are. Make them playing two-footed. Football, really.
That'd be even better. The best combinations we've had in the last, you know, sort of since I've been collecting stats, Denier and Van Dijk both right-footed, Ayer and Julian both right-footed. So,
honestly, I have a preconceived notion about left-footers. I very rarely trust them, depending on who they are. There's a theory that I have no evidence to back up, so you guys will murder me for it, but the left footers generally who are good with their left foot, they strike the ball much nicer. A left footed goal is much nicer to look at. But generally, Generally, left footers are way more awkward on the ball than right footers. That's my unbackupable opinion.
I don't know where to go with that, Enda. Sorry. I think we're on the wrong show now.
Yes, left-handers and their poor penmanship. That's the next topic.
Well, that's true. That is why people come for the expert opinion that you guys bring. People come for the notions that I bring to the show.
The irrational bigotry against left-footers from yourself.
That's exactly what they're coming to me for. Right, we'll crack through the other two questions about the defense. James, do you want to take one of them? So you have the issue of the gaps between Hart and the back line, and then you have the issue of passing with Starfelt Hart being uncomfortable on the ball.
Yeah, so I think they're interrelated, and I think it also interrelates with what McCarthy's role is going to be relative to McGregor. So I've talked about how these could kind of pile up on a risk basis. You know, if you put McCarthy in and you've got Starfelt and let's say Carter Vickers as your center backs potentially, or Welsh in for one of those two, either way, and with Hart being your keeper, I think that kind of diamond four, so to speak, is not ideal for the high line. It's not ideal for quick 1-2 touch passing and build up play out of the back. So there's going to be some inherent issues that I'm not sure are manageable, meaning that it's basically picking the poison that you're going to live with. So I don't know if you guys saw it, but there was a video that was going around today. I think it was from this week. I think it was under 21's Faroe Islands scored against France.
Oh yeah, they drew that game.
Yeah, yeah. And the way they scored was their France's keeper was way out, you know, where a sweeper keeper would be, close to the center line, to the circle, the center circle, and made a really bad pass. And the guy intercepted it and just shot from there. And it just dribbled over. I mean, it barely made it to the goal line. But that gave me visions of what a Joe Hart out at the center circle line might look like if he's out there with any frequency trying to, you know, play the ball as a kind of, you know, sweeper keeper, so to speak. So, you know, I don't think he should be going out there like that. I think he should be reserved and back. That's probably the lesser of the two evils, with him staying closer to his box where he's more comfortable. And that's just going to create that space. So maybe he gets better at coming for the ball. Like he made the mistake against Alkmaar and didn't. Hopefully he learns from that. Hopefully the communication gets better between the center backs and him with those lobs that are going to keep coming in that space. And, you know, hopefully we just get better at dealing with it with a little bit of practice as teams keep targeting it. But I think it's probably just going to be there. There's going to be some inherent issues with it. And, you know, hopefully it just doesn't compound to the point where it turns into big problems, you know, like a red card or something, you know, really bad where it ends up costing us points against a team that we shouldn't be losing points to.
Yeah, I guess the concern is with that gap in between the defense and the keeper is that teams will identify that and essentially get the ball out the wing and just knock balls over the top every single time and just create as much chaos as they possibly can in between a defense that aren't used to playing with each other so far.
And that's part of why I don't pretend to have watched him a ton. I've seen him play for the U.S. some, Carter Vickers, but I think he's okay pace-wise for a center back, but he's certainly not fast for a center back. You know, he's not anywhere in the neighborhood of an Ayer. So, you know, I would have liked to have seen that last piece coming in being a center back with some pace to complement either a Starfelt, you know, because I've said this since we signed Starfelt. I mean, it's like put him next to Julian playing that high line and there's not going to be any races in the 100-yard dash between the two of them that break the stopwatch. So, you know, we just don't really have any pay. I think probably Welsh might be the most agile of the group in recovery speed. And he's not anything, you know, great shakes in that regard. So I just, again, I think it's just going to be something that we live with.
Do you want to come in on that, Alan?
Yeah, sorry, Ender. I just wanted to, just going back to the previous conversation we had about, you know, pragmatism and will Postecoglou change his approach. I think he already is to basically try and reduce risk in those very areas. If you look at how Hart, you know, Hart clearly isn't coming out very far, and that creates another issue. So you've either got to drop the defense 5 yards to try and reduce that gap, because I don't think you're going to get 34-year-old Joe Hart to change fundamentally the way he plays to that degree. I mean, he's doing okay with his passing. He averages 28 completed open play passes per 90 minutes, and he gives away just under 5. I mean, that's probably a lot more effective than Gordon was, to be honest. And Gordon did a pretty good job of adapting his game under Rodgers to play that way. So I think he can adapt to a point, but it's within the structure of, you're not going to be standing on the halfway line or anywhere near that, because his recovery pace is just isn't going to be nothing like. So I think we're going to have to come up with a compromise. I think we already are coming up with a compromise. We may just need to drop that line a little bit back. And as for Starfelt, I mean, it might surprise you to know he averages more open play passes than any other player by 73 passes. And he loses the ball through his passing less than any other player. He gives it away just over 2 times. So again, there's a trade-off there between his relatively safe passing. He's not taking risks with his passing. He's giving it, he's not trying to break multiple lines. For example, you know, at Ibrox, he was very serviceful at getting past the front three, and he could get it into a midfielder or he'd get it into a fullback, you know, and he racks up plenty of those types of passes. And to be honest, that's okay, but you're not going to get that range of passing. So I think, and the other thing about Starfelt is, what was very interesting is away in Alkmaar, and he shifted from the left centre back to right centre back to, and I think it was to protect him, get him away from a Buchlau on that side, and that's where the danger came down. They had a new left back making his debut, and I can't remember who they brought in on the left. It was the other way around. They're basically trying to protect him from I think it was Larsson, wasn't it? Yeah, Carlson. Yeah. And then at Ibrox, they flipped it again because to try and keep him away from Kent. So he's being protected. As I said to you in the last show, he's being protected by Postecoglou. They're trying to build his confidence because it has taken a bit of a kicking. So that, to me, again, is evidence that the manager is adapting and trying to find ways to fix problems. He's not just saying, it's up to you to sort out, kick him out of the pitch and get on with it. There's more going on here.
Well, and I think that's a great point, Alan. And it, to me, again, it introduces just a different, you know, as I've always said, you know, risk tends not to get eliminated. It just morphs. So if the risk is inherent, meaning that, you know, if the pieces don't fit together, then you can kind of change where that risk lies, but you can't eliminate it. So to your point, you might be able to reduce it. Normally you just change the shape of it and then you might change the frequency of it. But so for example, and I agree with you, you know, the idea of maybe moving the line back 5 yards, but that then also might invite on more pressure, and Starfelt invites on more pressure with his safe passing, right? So because he's not really taking that blind breaking pass to cut open, so he's doing the simple passes. And again, if you throw McCarthy into that mix instead of McGregor, I can see scenarios where we're caught 10 to 15 yards deeper in build up play, and teams are just, you know, again, if they have the athleticism and the quality, just see, like, you know, like sharks in the, with blood in the water, just moving that forward. So that's a different manifestation of the risk. But it's situational. And again, this is where, what I always talk about is, for a lot of our opposition domestically, you know, most of this isn't going to matter. Because if they try to press us that aggressively, if Ross County comes in Sunday or Saturday and tries to aggressively press us forward, the likelihood is that we're going to absolutely carve them open. But, you know, when we go and play Leverkusen, totally different kettle of fish.
Mm. Well, another sort of issue with that safe passing is the over-reliance on Cal McGregor plays into that, because, I mean, if he's the guy that's always receiving the ball from the midfield and has to do something with it, if he gets injured, then where do you go from there? And also, you know, you can bring Cal McGregor into the game in other ways by, you know, doing what Christopher Ayer did, carrying the ball out, beating the first man, breaking the first line, and then suddenly there's space opening up in front of Cal McGregor to run onto the ball, as opposed to getting it and having to turn. And I suppose that addresses the question that came in about his left-sidedness. Just to finish up, there is one question from Mike Coast, who is asking a question of James, and James is the only one of us that can actually answer this question as far as I know. Are there lessons to be learned from the American NCAA programs that consistently perform and recruit above their relative size? Gonzaga basketball and Boise?
Yeah, Boise State.
Boise State football that can be applied to Celtic's future performances in Europe. So can you explain that firstly and then answer the question? Because I've got no fucking clue what that guy's asking.
Yeah. So both of those are universities that have developed very successful programs, even though they're not in major conferences. So you could think of them, the analogy I think that the questioner is asking, it's kind of like, you know, the Scottish League being outside of the Big Five. You know, so we're Celtics almost like a Boise State or a Gonzaga, which Gonzaga was in the NCAA basketball finals this past March, for example. So they don't play in one of the premier conferences where they have the big money and, you know, they pay their coaches $4 million a year, that kind of thing. So they've been able to build this very successful program as Boise State has, and just doing things a little differently. I think the analogies that is interesting. I think, so some of the things that I would say is optimization, and this is kind of a general key concept, which is, how do you make the best decisions and optimize the resources you have relative to your competitive situation, right? So how has Gonzaga done that? They've recruited a lot of foreign players. So they've kind of built this little niche where they bring guys in from Eastern Europe. They bring guys in from Africa, where, you know, your Kentuckys and your North Carolinas and your Duke, you know, kind of the traditional powers in college basketball, you know, their bread and butter is the best U.S. players, and basically giving them a pathway to the NBA very quickly. So what's happened is college basketball players, the best ones usually only come for 1 or 2 years and then they go pro because the money's so ridiculous, right? So the people that Gonzaga's recruiting are, you know, the 7'1" Lithuanian dude who's going to be there for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And they might come in a little raw, but they coach them up and they're at the university for 4 years. And by that third and fourth year, you've now got a really good player relative to what you could have, you know, because you're never going to compete for that, what they call five-star recruit that's going to Kentucky or Duke. You know, Gonzaga's very rarely going to be able to get that player. So they've been very smart about how they, you know, recruit and develop players and getting them to stick around for 3 or 4 years. Boise State, I think, is a little bit different because football's a little bit, American football's a little different. What they did is basically innovate an offense. So the way that they went about, they were one of the early teams to adopt what they call a spread offense. So it's almost like, you know, throwing all of your players out wide and just throwing the ball around like lunatics. So using space to their advantage, using quickness. And so being very creative in their play calling, taking risks. So they've been able to do it in a different way, which is just being smarter. I think they've been pretty on the forefront of analytics relative to that. And they're just as happy winning 65-50, which in American football is an insane score. Mm-hmm. But they've figured out a strategy. It's like, okay, we don't care if we give up 50 points because we'll score 60. And that kind of is Ange ball in a way. And you know, for the most part, they've started to lose a little bit of that because people have caught up, meaning that that kind of what they call spread offense has become a lot more, you know, they started that back in the mid-noughts, like 2005, 2006, 2007. So they were very early on the forefront of that. Now it's become quite popular. So they've lost some of that strategic edge as a result. The coolest thing about Boise State, other than the fact that they're in Idaho and no one knows where Idaho is that they play on a field that's a plastic pitch, so to speak, or an AstroTurf field that is blue. So if you ever want to tune in and watch a game, their turf is actually blue.
Yes, there's some that would go down that road, I think.
are there pundits in the American football scene that always give out about the state of the plastic pitches in Boise State and they have to get rid of them because
can you do it in Boise on a wet Tuesday night?
Yeah, exactly. And it does get wet and cold in Boise, I can tell you that.
I have no idea where Idaho is. That's all interesting though. Apart from the American football aspect, it's all fairly interesting, you know. There is the only issue I would rise with that is Celtic are not a progressive club at board level, so that is where you're running
into issues. The angle about what you were saying about recruitment, right? I mean, is purely synonymous. I mean, in a post-Brexit world, there's new angles to be pursued around which markets are now accessible that didn't used to be. And then that's what Celtic need to start exploring and really digging into, obviously, at the same time as overhauling recruitment and the way that whole operation runs, definitely.
And I've actually, you know, because, you know, we get accused of being spreadsheet geeks and all this stuff and the stat heads and, you know, focusing only on numbers. And I've said this consistently, and I 100% believe it. The people, the leadership, the culture is the most important part. So, you know, Boise State were able to create this kind of competitive advantage that was durable for a period of time. But you're all, you know, in these highly competitive environments, people are always copycatting. People are always kind of, you know, figuring out what you're doing. So it's having smart people that are able to innovate and stay ahead of the curve that's important and building a culture that enables that because, you know, these things are cyclical otherwise. And if you're, you know, you can continue to invest in, you know, data and you know, machine learning and all these various things, but so is everyone else. They're going to catch up. And, you know, it's like a never ending race as far as trying to stay ahead of the competition. So there's not really any such thing as a durable advantage, I think, other than building a culture that's going to, you know, be perpetually paranoid and always looking to innovate and stay ahead of the competition. And yeah. and to do it in a kind of vicious way, meaning that you know, it's part of one of the ways that the New England Patriots were so good for so long, for 20 years, other than having Tom Brady, which was a huge part of it, which was they were mercilessly vicious. Mm. You know, there was no sentimentality when a player got older, even if they had helped them win 3 or 4 Super Bowls. Goodbye.
Well, look at Alex Ferguson at Manchester United, and I mean, the guy who always gives out about me referencing the Premier League in this podcast will come back at me, but Brian Robson, captain Manchester United, gone. Roy Keane, when he was done, gone. Peter Schmeichel, gone. He was not afraid to get rid of key players if it meant that he could finally revitalize the team in the way that he needed to do. And I guess he's an old guard in a way now, that the way the things are done, but he was in full control and he did what he needed to do. I think the key point I would use to point towards the culture not being correct for this sort of innovative thinking in Celtic at the minute is the fact that Lawwell decided that after the 10 in a row is when things were going to change. That's when he was going to step down. That's when they were going to get a director of football. That's when they were going to revitalize the scouting system after the 10 in a row was done, as opposed to getting it done in the right way and having these people in place to continue to build on it. So I guess it might change over the next couple of years. Hopefully it does change, but I think that's where my skepticism around it would come. And if people don't like our data, they come to the podcast for my hot takes on the left-footed players.
I mean, that's right.
So I mean, all we can go on that one, and is, you know, you have to look at Mackay and where he came from and what he did at Scottish Rugby. You know, he did not have accountants in charge of the departments. He had a marketing person in charge of marketing. You know, he had a salesperson in charge of sales. He had a rugby expert in charge of recruitment and scouting plans, and that's how you do it. You find talented people and you give them the authority and the mandate to do their job properly, and you give them the tools to do the job properly, and then you support them 100%, and then you hold them to account, and that's how you drive excellence. And Mackay has got a track record for doing that in a sporting environment. So I'd definitely be up for giving him a chance to instill that culture at Celtic.
Yeah, well, we will live in hope that happens. This was the first Q&A off the Huddle Breakdown. I think it was a massive success, if I do say so myself. We will actually have a game to look forward to and look back on, the Ross County game this weekend and the Real Betis game next week. So that's what next week's show is going to be. If you want to get that, you have to subscribe to the YouTube channel below, subscribe to the podcast network at Huddle Breakdown, and follow us on Twitter at Huddle Breakdown or The Breakdown Inc. James, Alan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Have a good week, guys.
All right. Thanks for your question, folks. We'll chat to you later. Good luck.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.